You are now listening to Health Yas Tig on Chilcotin Radio 104.5 FM.
Hello, my name is Travis Stump, and I am a South Coast teen from Anaheim Reserve. And we're here today with Judy Gentry, was it?
Ventry.
No. Ventry, yeah. Sorry.
That's
Judy
okay.
Ventry. It's nice to meet you. Yeah.
Sachinalia, Hunoshta, Seeds Auzi, Judy Pinchbeck Ventry, Setsera, Williams Lake Desney, Anna Nestlin. I'm just learning Selshkotin, so I'm just introducing myself, saying greetings. My name is Judy Pinchbeck Ventry, and I'm from Williams Lake. I'm also Shuswap. My ancestors come from, it's Chief William of Williams Lake is actually my great-great-great-grandfather. My family was also, settler side of my family was Pinchbeck, so obviously the first white settler. So there's a bit of history there in my family, but I also have half-siblings that are all band members of Unisateen. So I grew up, my childhood, spending a lot of times out in Honey Gwateen. Very beautiful, and it's like very near and dear to my heart. I was just out there recently and had a lot of wonderful childhood memories come flooding back. My aunt and uncle lived out there and just recently sold their place. I feel very deep roots here in this area. So, but I am living in Williams Lake, so that's my home right now. So happy to be here today.
Okay, thank you for that introduction. Yeah, it's always nice to know where people are from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're here today just to talk a little bit about overall health when it comes to addictions and mental health, I guess, comes with it also. First question, mental wellness and addictions is a very important topic right now with the toxic drug crisis. What are some things that you feel is important to people to know?
Well, interestingly enough, I have spent, at least 16 years as a volunteer in an addiction recovery 12-step program. So I do have some lived experience with family members who have had struggles with addiction, and myself being a family member who was struggling to support that person. And my current role with the Selshkotin National Government is a project manager for the Selshkotin Healing and Wellness Center. Mm-hmm. So I feel very passionately about this subject, and that's why I was sort of invited to come here today and talk about this mental health and addictions and how they do go together. I think of my own, I have a daughter who has high-functioning autism, ADHD, borderline personality disorder, plethora of complexities there. It's been challenging, but I've learned so much from raising her and knowing that she is a vulnerable person who very easily gets pulled into the crowds of those struggling with substance misuse because they are a very accepting crowd. They don't care if you have social skill issues or quirky behaviors. They'll accept anybody. That's how mental health and addiction sometimes end up in the same realm. And I remember, when I used to work with the Ministry of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, I was a community integration specialist. So it was kind mm-hmm. of like worked out on the streets with those who were struggling with homelessness and addiction and listening to their stories and where they ended up, how they ended up on the streets like that. And it was just heart-wrenching because majority of them were First Nations and the majority of them were survivors of residential school or day school. And, this is something that the general population sometimes wants to forget or quit talking about. It makes them uncomfortable. Nobody wants this dark past. I myself have settler, I was a family member of the first white settler to this area, and some judge me for that. I also have Indigenous blood, and I'm so proud of that and always have been, probably because I was raised with white privilege. I haven't had the discrimination, that a lot of my family members have, and and it's an unfair thing, but, you know, what causes people to end up in addiction oftentimes is trauma. Usually it's childhood trauma. And sometimes this disease, and that's what it is, it's a disease. It's not a choice. Like some people, I hear a lot of this topic lately talking about, you know, they chose to be there.
Yeah.
They can choose to get out of it. Mm. Well, it's actually a disease. So they're actually, you know, trapped in this cycle of addiction, and it isn't.
Yeah.
Okay. It's very rare that somebody can get out of that on their own. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a very, very important topic. And what I think it's important to know about addiction is that it is a disease and not a choice. That is a fact that's backed up by science. That's not just my personal opinion, you know, that it is a disease. It robs people of the freedom to choose. Addiction hijacks, you know, the brain neuropathways, and so that they do lose their agency. That's their freedom to choose right from wrong. It's their free will to stop, you know, what they know is ruining their lives. They can't help it. It's like this crazy cyclone of like just vacuum that just sucks them in, and they can't get out of it. So they're literally disconnected from their will, agency, yeah, from their families, because they ruin family relationships because of the addiction. And they're driven into isolation and loneliness, and that's where addiction thrives. Mm. So disconnection is where addiction thrives. So when someone is isolated and alone, that's where the addiction will grow and get more of a hold on that person. So what we can do as family members who have loved ones that are suffering is not allow those connections to be broken. Like, do not stop loving that person. Don't withhold love because they're struggling. And it's a really hard thing to have unconditional love. And that means if you stop using, I will love you then. No, you can't do that. You have to love unconditionally all the time. You can absolutely set boundaries because, you know, there are consequences when you're using addiction. You know, addiction causes people to do bad things. That doesn't mean they're a bad person. You know, they do these things to feed this addiction that's got control and power over them. It's an evil thing, and it's really hard to come out of that without love and unconditional love at that. So family members who would be willing to go and, you know, sit with that person, hold space with that person. And that's something that, you know, I had a lot of success when I was working for the ministry with folks on the streets, because they could see that I was genuine, that I cared about them, and that I was sincere. And I wasn't trying to fix them or make them do anything. I was meeting them where they were at and asking them, you know, becoming friends with them. You know, some of these folks became like really dear to my heart. And yeah, I've since lost them because of the, you know, the toxic, you know, poisonings that are happening with drug use nowadays. So, but I think it's just really important to understand that these, our loved ones can't help themselves. Like, we have to be that love piece that anchors them to this, you know, to want to have something to live for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was great. Thank you. It brought up a lot of thoughts that I had about my own family, thinking about what you said, and I could see that generational trauma, as they say, it not only affects my grandfather or my father, but me also.
Good point. Yeah, that is totally true. And something that I forgot to mention is the predisposition for addiction sometimes is in our DNA.
Yeah.
So if we had, you know, a grandfather that was an alcoholic and grandmother that was an alcoholic, our parents mm-hmm. became alcoholics, that's in DNA. It actually can change the DNA so that when I'm born, that if I partake of a drink of alcohol, yeah, I will become an addict. And that's unfair, because this person over here might be able to have a glass of wine every night and never become an addict. That's a predisposition. And that's something that sometimes it becomes imprinted in our DNA. So it's an unfair disease.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it. And another thing that kind of got to me was I feel like it all started when we got disconnected from our own ways of living, like I don't know, traditional ways of living. Like after we went to residential school and started getting taught how to live, that's when it really started. We lost our way, and then we started using the easiest way out was drugs and alcohol. So
that is a really massive point, and I'm glad you brought that up, because culture and language are the things that ground First Nations people. So what a genius plan. I don't even think that a man could have thought this up. I think it comes from a more evil place than that. To think that if we take the children away from these people, and what the mandate at the time was to take the Indian out of the people, how do they do that? Like, remove the language. That's so powerful. Like, I'm a learner of Indigenous language. I'm learning Sashkotin, which I'm loving, you know, the learning piece. And I'm so grateful that I took my Shwepmchin too. So I have, you know, a language proficiency certificate in Shwepmchin, and it has helped me, even though they're two completely different languages. Some of the sounds that you make, you know, in the First Nations languages, you know, those are rooted in something beyond man. What I realized as a student of this language is that this is a divine language. This is not a man-made language. This is something that Creator gifted, our ancestors. And so I had this most spiritual experience, you know, learning the language. And wow, like the power that just comes from that one practice. Mm-hmm. So robbing, you know, First Nations of their language and then the culture, like, and, you know, that is so powerful. So what is the opposite to, you know, isolation and disconnection for someone who's struggling with addiction? Mm-hmm. Is the opposite is, you know, the culture and speaking the language to those who know the language, you know. And, you know, there was one fellow that was, I think he told me he was in corrections for 35 years of his 57 years of life. Mm-hmm. He still spoke fluent, you know, Shwepmchin. He could speak the language, and he understood everything that was being said to him in the language. And that, you know, that I always wonder, like, if he would have had that opportunity to have people speaking to him in the language, is that something that would have been powerful enough to bring him out of his struggles? But yeah, that family connection and that connection to culture is I don't think people realize the power in that.
Yeah, exactly. And we're slowly getting back into it again, over time. Because when I was a kid going to school, like, I probably, the most cultural thing I probably did was, like, we went fishing, like, once, probably, that I could remember for a school trip. And then we went to, Lady Rock? So seeing children nowadays, like my people have more cultural stuff is a cool thing to say.
It is, and it's like the power is coming back. And you know, there's two things that we didn't talk about, and that's the pillars of addiction, which are guilt and shame. And those are two things that were pounded into students of residential school. And then, you know, those students grow up to be parents who have never been taught love, because they didn't get to be with their families. You know, they got robbed of all of that. And so this cycle begins, and guilting and shaming that happened at residential school because of the color of skin, the color of, or the length of hair, the language, you know, that becomes something that's innate, like becomes a part of who we are. And that is, you know, a massive cause of addiction, guilt and shame. And so it's hard to, like, you know, get the youth to understand that language and culture is something to be proud of. It's not something to be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, there's, I think this, we live in an area that's systemically racist, period.
Yeah.
I myself had to look at my own biases. Even though I have First Nation ancestry, I was raised with white privilege, as I say. And what that means is, you know, when I look in the mirror, I don't see the dark skin and the hair color and eye color that could get me in trouble with the police if they pulled me over. I don't have to fear that, you know. Mm. That's being raised with white privilege. You know, that is something that just happened to me. And then also, as I got older, growing up in this town, you know, I didn't realize that I had racist biases. I didn't want them, and I certainly didn't choose them, but they were in there because it was learned behavior as a child, you know, growing up with this around. And it's something that I'm actually writing a book about because I'm so passionate about the systemic racism thing. Mm. People are, you know, don't want to look inside and see, you know, what thoughts are going through my head when I look at this person on the street. You know, and that's what I fear is this, you know, lumping people with addiction and mental health issues, like throwing them like that they're some criminal.
Yeah. Or it's like concerning. Some kind of other species or something.
Yeah. Dehumanizing. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But kind of getting off topic on there, but I feel like you kind of went over this already, but this is the next question. How would you define addictions?
Mm. I'm actually glad you asked that question because we've been talking about, you know, the obvious addiction of substance misuse. That's the socially unacceptable addiction. But what is addiction really? It's when you have a strong physical or mental need or an urge to do something regardless of the consequence. So if you think about that, I can use myself as an example because I'm a firm believer that every human being is addicted to something. Mm-hmm. For me, it's probably carbohydrates because, you know, I've been in a 25-year battle with weight. You know, I'm trying to get my post, you know, weight off from having my last baby. 25 years, my baby is 25 years old now. It's like time to get this off. But, you know, I have this carbohydrate addiction that I decide I'm not going to eat after 6 o'clock at night, and I'll sit down in the evening to relax and watch something on TV. And all of a sudden I'll be like, popcorn would be really good right now. You know, these little thoughts go through our head. But the next thing I find myself standing at the fridge, opening the fridge up, and I'm looking in there. I don't want to eat after 6 o'clock, but yet I'm standing there and then I'm hungry. But am I really hungry? Is that brain hunger or is that physical hunger? You know, this is what an addiction behaves like. You know, we all have addiction because we all, you know, it's a dopamine release in the brain. Our brains have a pleasure center that releases dopamine as a reward. And this is what keeps us alive. So, example, when we get hungry, we will eat food and that will release a certain amount of dopamine in our brain and it will be like satisfying. And so we, you know, continue that behavior. So some of them socially acceptable behaviors, but we can get addicted to things like food can become an addiction. Sugar can be an addictive substance. Caffeine, you know, we see people drinking too many coffees, you know, or monster drinks, you know, these kinds of things these energy drinks that have massive amounts of caffeine. Sex can become an addictive behavior. Pornography, gambling, codependency, gaming is a new one. You know, this, you know, younger generation that struggles with, like, I mean, I've learned so much from my daughter that, you know, has autism. And I see her when, you know, I've tried to encourage her to game with people, like, because she craves social interaction. And so this live gaming, you know, you can get on there and game with other people. And she starts doing that. Then I watch her total behavior change and she becomes a little monster. And I'm like, okay, you need to get off that game. That Fortnite game is changing your very nature. Yeah. You're not your nice self anymore. You're becoming this little, you know, these are addictive behaviors that can get out of control. So phones and social media. You know, trying to get someone to put down their cell phone for a while and not touch it. Like, just try to not touch your phone for an hour and see if you can do that. You know, these are like socially acceptable addictive behaviors. But then we get on to the prescription medication, the drugs and alcohol. You know, those are more socially unacceptable and they really change the way our brain chemistry is. And so that changes our very nature of who we are. And so, yeah, that's I'm glad you did ask that, because I think we are quick to judge as human beings others who we can obviously see struggling with addiction, but we don't take the time to look at our own self and think, okay, I want to stop this behavior, and I can't because I'm compelled to do it for some reason.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an addiction. An addictive behavior is different than addiction to substance. So.
Mm. No, it's great to look at it that way, because everything could be an addiction if you look at it from a certain point of view.
Yeah. And you know, it's way easier, like, when you have the socially acceptable addictive tendencies, you know, you can hide those a lot of the time, and it still has power over you. Mm. And, you know, I was one who, when my family members struggled with addiction, and I was offering conditional love, you know.
Yeah.
If you would stop doing this, then, you know, we would have a better relationship. Or look at what you're doing to our finances. You're ruining our financial future. You're robbing from your children because of this, you know, this addiction. And I was very judgmental because I didn't understand. Mm. So, you know, I was so grateful to go to a 12-step AA meeting and learn from other people's stories, listening to the sharing of the struggle people were going through. And it validated everything that I was being told, but disbelieving. And so, you know, that's why those 12-step programs are so powerful, because, you know, there's testimony being shared there, and you recognize truth when you hear it.
Yes.
And then it's like, that's what's changed my heart towards addiction and to those who are struggling with that, you know, substance misuse, because I used to be that judgmental person, but I am thankfully no longer that person anymore. And I've taken another lens to look at it through.
Yeah.
And I have empathy and understanding. And I think that's what we could all do, is just educate ourselves a little more on addiction.
Yeah.
You know, recently, the South Dakota National Government, along with Interior Health and along with First Nations Health Authority, put on a very amazing toxic drug forum, and that happened just about 2 weeks ago. We hosted it here at the curling rink. You know, there was about 300 people in attendance there. We had four different nations, you know, Shwepam, Northern Shwepam, South Dakota, Dekeltane, and the Nuhok nations were all invited. So we had 17 different First Nation communities, all the way up to Nazco, Kleskas. All of these communities came together in one space with the chiefs, and we all had this really important, you know, topic to discuss. And we had speakers who were doctors in the field speak at this forum. And so if people missed that, it is still available on YouTube. Thankfully, TNG did host it on live on YouTube, and you can go back and you can search in YouTube Reclaiming Our Indigenous Spirit, TNG's Toxic Drug Forum. Put those in the search and you'll find those 2 days. You know, if you don't have time to watch the whole 6-hour forum, then you can like look through the speakers. There was a Dr. Nathaniel Day that spoke from Alberta on the second day, and he was phenomenal, and he really connected to, like, a lot of the feedback was they want what he's doing in Alberta to happen here in BC. You know, he's working with a lot of First Nation communities and helping them be successful, and they have proven things that are working in these First Nation communities. So I think, you know, educating ourselves and quit being opinionated about things like I used to be, and actually educate yourself, and that will help overcome ignorance.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's good thing to do, is to learn a little bit what you're talking about, you know. It's and then actually it took me a little bit of time, but when I was a little bit younger, say I'm 35 now, so when I was like 20-25, I used to judge a lot of people and what they would do and stuff like that, and then I got older and I got to learn about it a little bit more, and I'm like, they're going through their own things too, so it's like so I can't be that person that judges everyone, so
exactly. Yeah. That's a Exactly. Good point to make because, you know, that's, I think when you get doctors and science explaining things to you and you really understand, you can't be judgmental if you really understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. Question number three here. If individuals find themselves engaging in addictive behaviors, what advice would you give them?
Well, if they want help and they want to stop, I would say ask somebody, talk to somebody. You know, remember we were talking about how addiction thrives in isolation. Mm-hmm. So if you have a secret and you're got this really bad behavior that's causing you or your loved ones harm and you want to make it stop, you have to ask for help. You know, white knuckling it is never going to work. That's how relapse happens, you know.
Yeah.
People try to stop. They can quit for a certain amount of time with willpower, but that'll only last for so long. Usually 3 days, you know, is when that real willpower starts to fail.
Starts to go away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, so they start struggling. So asking for help and talking to someone who you trust. Yeah. And that's sometimes hard because we judge ourselves so harshly.
Yes.
So that's why we never need to guilt and shame our loved ones who are struggling because they already feel massive amounts of guilt and shame and they're already isolating. What we need to do is bring them back and say, you know, you don't know the powerful human you are and like breathe that life back into them about who they are because they are not their addiction. Those are two separate things. And so talking to somebody that you trust and as a family member or even a service provider, you know, just loving people where they're at. Mm. You know, if they're not willing to get help right now, it's because they don't trust anything or anybody. The system is going to fail them or they're scared. You know, there's nobody wants their life to be total havoc. But you know, if they learn to trust someone or people can meet them where they're at and build a relationship of trust, they will start to talk.
Yeah.
But I would just say if you are trapped in some behaviors that you're worried about, find somebody that you can trust to talk to, whether it be, you know, a peer. There are lots of peer supports around nowadays. Talk to somebody who's lived through it because they can help you through. And don't try to do it alone because that's, again, isolation where the addiction will thrive and you'll get, you know, sunk more deep into the addiction. So I would just say, you know, remember that step one in the 12 steps is honesty and just be true to yourself and then ask for help.
The 12 steps, meaning the doubly.
Yeah.
Doubly. Steps, okay.
Yeah, you're right. Like 12-step recovery program, it can be 12 steps of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or NA, Narcotics Anonymous. Okay. Al-Anon even uses the 12 steps, you know. Mm. So it's just adapted to you know, whatever substance or use that. But the 12 steps are powerful, you know, and they do work.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't, you know, have been around for so long, and I've heard so many success stories, you know, of people who have used the 12 steps to help them. And it doesn't mean you can use those 12 steps and get off of anything. You sometimes still need help, you know. Mm-hmm. You might need medication to help you. You might need, you know, hospitalization. You might need treatment, any of those things, you know. But just sharing your burden with somebody else is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's always good to let it out if you're yourself there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hold it in for too long there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, last question here. Asking for help is important, and we have heard lots about lack of resources out there. What type of help is out there for people in the Saskatoon territory and Williams Lake?
Oh, good question. Well, I'll start off with Williams Lake because that's where we're at right now. But in Williams Lake, you know, there are service providers that support those who are struggling. And a great one is Canadian Mental Health Association, you know, CMHA. Mm-hmm. They have outreach people. They have Housing First people. They have access to treatment beds. You know, they have purchased treatment beds at Red Road Recovery, which is a very successful Indigenous-focused treatment facility, and CMHA has access to beds there. And Caribou Friendship Society is another service provider in town that has a shelter and they provide food. Boys and Girls Club is another, hub that people can go to mm-hmm. to access services. And we have, we have Nankini Family Treatment. And then there's also in Esquette, there's Le Twelch Wen Semech. And that is a recovery house that is for people who have been through treatment and okay. they need somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. You know, they can go there for, it doesn't matter what nationality you are. It doesn't matter, where you've come from, whether you're Indigenous, non-Indigenous, anybody can access that service. And it's, a post-treatment recovery house where they can, have time to learn some skills, life skills, and just to move from that structured treatment center to, post-treatment recovery where they sort of can come back into integrate back into their normal life, So there's those, and there's Foundry for youth. So that's under the age of 24. The Foundry here in Williams Lake is a great resource. And then Interior Health has a new model called The Junction, and it's kind of for all stages of recovery. So whether you're in active use, not willing to quit, but you just want support, you can access services there. People who have completely gone through treatment and they're in post-recovery, they can come back to The Junction and as, maintaining their sobriety or as peer support. That's step 12 of that 12-step program we're talking about is service, giving yeah. back. So, coming back as a peer is a great way to keep sobriety. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm the most passionate about is the project that I've been working on that I was hired to do with TNG and with Eunice 18 because they purchased the Deer Creek Ranch for a healing and wellness model. Mm-hmm. So that's, my job has been trying to figure out where the gaps are in the system. And knowing that our system is very broken, accessing detox, for example, is a challenge. And, Tlesco has their health director there has started a home detox program, which is very exciting. So, that helps take the burden off the hospital, but also helps those who feel, barriers to the hospital for obvious reasons that we won't get into. But, the program that I'm working on is to find detox through transitional housing so that when people detox, we have partnered with Red Road Recovery. So we are starting a model in the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, which is going to be called Red Road River. And Red Road River Tselchko will be located on the Tchokotan River. It will be at the Deer Creek Ranch area, and it will be a place where people can go and utilize culture and traditional mm-hmm. practices to heal. And so we will have a private detox run from hopefully in Williams Lake here. We're working with our partners with Ministry of Health to try to find that right fit of where the detox will be. We'll be utilizing, Red Road's partners with Day One. That's a well-known detox facility out of Kamloops that will be mm-hmm. supporting this initiative. And so we will have detox, and then it will go to transitional housing where folks can, detox for 7 days, then they need to move on. Sometimes treatment's not ready for them. So we have this transition housing where people can stay safe and continue in programming so they can it's kind of supportive recovery. Mm-hmm. And then they will go from there to treatment, and that would be down at Deer Creek Ranch. And then once they're finished treatment, that goes for usually 90 days, then they can come back to transitional housing. And they can stay there for up to a 2-year period. So that gives people time for their brains to heal. Because yes. after using substances for long periods of time, sometimes it can take 2 years for that brain to recover.
Okay.
But the great thing is that it can recover. And so people can, come back to having a functioning life. And
yes.
in that recovery phase, they'll be able to have life skills, job skills, and sometimes support people in work so they can actually, and it takes time to find housing and figure out where they want to live, if they want to go back to community or relocate. You know, all of those pieces will help support them through so they're not lost in the system. And that's, you know, what I'm very excited about, because I feel like this is the whole package, and it's going to be Selchkotin led.
Yeah.
It is wonderful that, you know, Chief Lennon Solomon is very passionate about this and has talked about it for a long time. And he is not saying that only Selchkotin will benefit from this. He's opening it to all nations. So whether you're Shohwepm or if you're non-Indigenous, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you are going to be welcome. So it's a very exciting project. And it's, you know, we're hoping to make a formal announcement, but we're working on budgets with the Ministry of Health. But we hope that, you know, soon we'll be able to launch this program. So very exciting stuff.
Yes, it sounds awesome, because I've seen it on Facebook, some pictures of Deer Creek Ranch, and it looks like it's coming along great now.
It really is, and it's like, even not so much the buildings, but just the land. When you drive in there and you step out of your vehicle, it's just, it has this feeling, and I know that it's, you know, foreordained for this purpose. It's going to be exciting to see, you know, people be able to heal and heal in an Indigenous safe, you know, culturally safe way. Something that's desperately needed. So.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. I just want to bring up one other thing that you brought up. Talking about how it takes like a long time for the human body to recover. That's a great point, but it just brought up a thought in my own head was it almost doesn't really matter how much damage you do to your body. If you start healing yourself, your body knows what to do, like when it comes to healing itself. Like your most powerful part of your body is your liver. Like it, no matter what you do to it, it'll come back once you stop doing bad stuff to it. So that's a great thing. It's like the human body is very powerful when you let it do its thing. So
that is a very good point. And it is. The liver is an amazing organ, and all, you know, the power of the body is like beyond understanding. Even like the more you learn about it, the more fascinating it becomes.
Yeah.
But even like nature is so powerful. You know the body can withstand with stress and trauma. You know, that requires extra help sometimes to move through that, and that's where nature comes into place. It's just such a powerful space out there, the water and the land, and you know, being able to practice. You know, doing sweat ceremony and, you know, experiencing that and even just doing the traditional practices of fishing and, you know, drying the fish food preservation and those kinds of things. The community that happens from that kind of exercise is so powerful. And there's rebuilding those connections, right?
Yeah.
So the healing physically, like you're talking about, it's a miracle, really. It's going to happen. It's exciting.
Yeah, just for example, I'm not doing as much now, but there's a point where I was like smoking like probably 10 cigarettes a day. So I woke up one morning and I didn't get up out of bed right away. I was just laying in bed, and I was listening to myself breathe, and I was actually wheezing. Like, you know how you sound when you can't really get air in your body, like wheezing. And I was like, I gotta quit doing what I'm doing. So the next day I quit smoking cigarettes, and then a week later I quit smoking weed.
Wow.
And I was off both of them for like probably a good 5-6 years. So. And then there's a little stint like a couple of years ago where I started doing weed and cigarettes again, but the thing is, when I quit, I started working out too, like running, and run one day, and then the next day I'd work out like lifting weights, and then just keep doing that. So like first time I ran, though, is kind of funny. I ran probably like not even like football field length, and I was like just puffing away. So, but 5 months later, after doing it like for 5 months straight, I could run for an hour straight before I had to stop.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. In the science, you know, yeah, that when you quit, mm-hmm, you know, you added years to your life. It's
yeah,
phenomenal.
Exactly. Yeah. And then just reading, like I read up about health stuff and how to eat healthy too. And just walking every day can significantly enhance your longevity of life. So,
and that's good to hear, because that's something I do every day after work, because I have to go for a walk just to unwind and decompress. Mm. And, you know, sometimes I'll walk to exercise and sometimes I'll walk to stroll to just like just listen to the birds. I'll shut my music off and just listen to nature. And, you know, sometimes, you know, that's just all it takes, is, you know, just connecting to nature and, you know, allowing it to help us and talk to us sometimes. So I'm glad that you did that. And it's pretty amazing, like, to meet people who actually can overcome on their own just by willpower. Mm. It's very rare.
Yeah, like you said about the 3-day thing, like that happened to me when I first quit cigarettes. It was literally 3 days. That's like, it was the worst 3 days of my life.
Yeah. It's funny. I learned that from my loved one who struggled with addiction, and it's like 3 days. Then there's a 3-week one that will get you.
Yeah.
3 months. There's something about the number three.
Yeah.
But it's a challenge for sure.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely helps if you have a support person or someone to be accountable to.
Yeah.
That's definitely helpful when you have that. But your accountability, obviously, you took a, you know, a redirection focused on your health and well-being, and then you find that you get those natural endorphins that release in your body when you lift weights and when you work out. Then you can it's almost like you're compelled to go do that again.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I noticed that too when I was working out. It's like a natural. You get a natural high from it.
So. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And,
what else was it? I did. My dad told me a long time ago too that before you even work out, like even lift one weight, you should stretch. He goes, so I needed something to stretch before I started working out, and afterwards stretch again, he said. So I started doing yoga. So yoga, and then I'll work out, and then I'll do yoga again. So,
wow, that's amazing.
So that really helped me with my, with yoga, the main thing is how to breathe properly. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
getting in touch with your breathing rhythm.
Exactly. So, yoga's super powerful, not just the stretching, but the just the mindfulness of it, like being aware, body aware. Mm. Something I forgot to mention is, you know, we're talking about resources.
Yes.
There's this amazing group from Bonaparte that is doing a ceremony for people. It's Calling Our People Home is the name of it, and it's talking about ending stigma and healing for all. And I'm so moved by this, and it's happening in the park on June 19th. And so it goes from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. I think this is posted on the TNG Facebook page.
Yeah.
There's going to be, you know, smudging, drumming, singing, and ceremony. So definitely hope folks can come out and participate in that and help call our people home and end the stigma about addiction.
Yes, yes. When the guy was talking about it there, he said this was the third one he was having, and the first two was held in Kamloops. So the third one will be held here in Williams Lake at Betonia Park on June 19th between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m.
Awesome.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was nice to talk to you.
Awesome. I'm grateful for the time to talk about this really important subject. It's very near and dear to my heart. So, Sachin Aliyah, for allowing me to come in and talk to you.
Yeah, thank you.